Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Dreaming of the perfect getaway from the office? Maybe you want to travel to Europe for a couple weeks or go on a cruise from New York to Southampton. With a hectic work schedule, sometimes these dream vacations seem out of reach. But this employer-matched travel savings program might be able to help make your dreams a reality. Erica Pearson is co-founder and CEO of Vacation Fund. She joins us to tell us more about her program. Then we get real about your rewards card. Christopher Elliott is an author, journalist, and founder of Elliott Advocacy. He's here to tell us why you should cut your rewards card into teeny tiny pieces. Then we're going to talk to Phil Buchanan about his new book, Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. And for all you digital savvy Canadians, Motus Bank COO David Baldarelli is going to be here to talk about Canada's new full-service digital bank. Do we need another one? I don't know. Plus, Kelly Keene, personal finance educator and consumer advocate for FP Canada. She takes us through the 2019 household debt survey and gives us some tips on how Canadians can tackle their debt. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Time is money. There is no doubt about that. So what better way to spend your time than a vacation? Vacation Fund just might be the solution you need to help you get some time away from the office. Erica Pearson is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Vacation Fund. She joins us now to talk about an employer-matched travel savings program. Hello there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What is Vacation Fund and how does it work? I mean, we've got companies offer the most hilarious and amazing benefits these days, all sorts of things, sleep rooms in addition to dental and massage, but now they'll help you go on a vacation?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and it's kind of funny because we're a little bit late to the benefits party overall, but I'd initially, I went into finance. I was going to leave finance. I just wanted to help people save for their travel goals because growing up, that was pretty much the only thing my father was willing to spend money on, taking our family on 3 trips a year. So I looked back on that. By the time I turned 22, I'd been to over 40 countries, and I said, I want to help more people do that. So I'd seen Bucket List, Bucket Dream, Bucket Listy, all these bucket list platforms, and I said, well, that's great, but you would understand even better than I do. If people are not saving for these things, they'll never get there. A safari is really expensive.
Yeah.
A trip to the Arctic is really expensive. So I initially just wanted to create this automated savings tool for people's travel goals. And as I started asking people, what prevents you from going on vacation? 50% of people said, I don't have the budget. And the other 50% said, I'm really hesitant to ask for time off. And around that time, I'd started pitching to tech CEOs in Toronto. And they said, do you know how tight this labor market is? This sounds like it resonates with this generation, with millennials especially, more than anything. What if we put money towards people's vacations and show them we actually really want them to take their time off? And I thought, well, that sounds like the perfect solution.
Now you're talking. So tell me how does this work with an employer's benefit program? Is it auto enrollment like it would be on a DC pension plan, or how does it work?
Yeah, so we actually coordinate, depending on which payroll provider the company uses, we coordinate this because so far, because we're not dictating where people can spend the funds, we're not saying, look, you can only spend the funds with one of our travel partners. We didn't want to play that role because we don't think it's right to tell someone, hey, you know that 4-day, 5-day camping trip with your family that you can't use your vacation fund money for that.
Yeah, you have to go to Thailand with G Adventures. That's the only trip you're allowed to do.
Which is pretty epic, but not for everyone. So with us taking that approach, this is always taxed as income. So employees make after-tax payroll contributions into their vacation fund, and employers can decide if they want to do the match before tax or after tax. It's typically a 50% match capped at a certain dollar amount per paycheck. So anywhere between a match up to a 50% match up to $20 all the way up to $100 a paycheck.
And what would be the max match that an employer has offered currently? Not to say that there aren't more generous employers out there, but is this $1,000? Is it $5,000? What's the max match?
Yeah, well, and what's interesting with that question is before we'd even pivoted, we looked up all the companies in the United States. There's about 10 companies that do what they were calling paid vacations, paid time off that the company was funding. And a company called Basecamp in Chicago actually was one of the very first ones doing this, saying, we're going to pay you $5,000 a year, use it or lose it, to go on vacation. Wow. There's a company out of Colorado that pays $7,500 a year, use it or lose it, to go on vacation. Now, most companies are not going to that extreme, but that was a good way for us to go approach those companies saying, hey, have you found that this has been successful? Do you think it can be successful as a matching program with people matching lower dollar amounts? So the highest dollar amount we've seen as a match per year is $1,000 a year. But that typically, as a 50% match, that means the employee themselves has to be responsible putting aside $2,000 for that year in order to earn their full $1,000 match. And $3,000 for a vacation is not too bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good, actually. Now, there is a real values element here at play for some companies. It is true and it is authentic. They want their people to take vacations. Yeah. How common is that really, and how much is it just talk?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We are actually now getting more familiar with what companies is this actually a fit for and what companies are the most eager to adopt this. And it's surprising, actually, because now we've come to the conclusion that this is mostly for companies in creative or innovative industries where it's very competitive. People are working very hard, but what they can come up with in their minds and the ability to be innovative or creative is significantly better when they're not burning out or they're not overworking themselves. So it's these companies that realize how important their employees' mental capacity is when they're in the office that are the ones that are pushing them to take time away from the office. So the line we'd previously actually been using is this is the best benefit for ambitious employees. If your workforce has people punching in, punching out, and putting in a good day's work, that's totally fine. But those don't seem to be the companies that actually need to push people out the door and push people out the door because they're so ambitious that they're hesitant to ask for time off because they're trying to prove themselves and work hard for the company and not let their colleagues down. So there's a lot of psychology that actually goes into the things that are preventing people in companies like that from taking the time off. And there's been enough employers that have said, oh, we don't do unlimited vacations. This is becoming a liability on our balance sheet. People are not taking their days. We really need them to.
And how do you make your money?
So we just charge the company a subscription fee. It typically comes out to around $3 to $5 per employee per month, depending on the size of the company. And that's for platform access, customer service. We make sure everything's coordinated with the payroll provider. We do all the record keeping. We also ask these companies what they want the conditions to be for employees to be able to request to withdraw that money that they've put towards their vacations. Most companies typically say, hey, we'll give the person their match as long as they're using vacation days in order to spend it. So ideally, they're traveling away from home. They're traveling at least 2 hours away from home. But some people have said, look, if people have newborn kids at home, and they just want to order a nice meal for their family, right, or they want to do a day trip somewhere, like, we're still not in a position to say, no, you can't use your vacation fund money for that. Like, if people are using a day off, that's fine.
I love this idea. And that said, it's a bit limited in terms of the share of wallet of the benefits pie. Do you foresee in 5 years you're going to offer a whole bunch of other services, or are you going to get bought by Great West Life or Sun Life or any of the other, or one of the EAPs? What's the future for your company?
Well, it's interesting because we actually play in the fintech space, in the travel tech space, and in the HR tech space. So the biggest place where I see opportunity and where other people have expressed to me that we've really got a lot more to this than we're taking advantage of right now is that we have people setting travel goals on our platform, right? We know where people want to go, what time of the year, and what their budget is for the breakdown of flights to accommodations to excursions. And we know how much money is sitting in their vacation fund account to be spent on these things. So to us, it's kind of like, okay, well, if we have a closed group of users and we could actually show people offers better than what's publicly available, we just want to continue to grow our user base and pull down the barriers that prevent people from being able to go away, whether it's time, whether it's money, whether it's guilt and fear and uncertainty. And that gets us closer to saying, okay, now now we can go back to this idea of, well, let's kind of revolutionize the way people save and spend on travel. Like, people have earned their trip before they're going away. They actually didn't need to go into debt to do it. So
does the money sit with you in trust, or is it in somewhere else?
Yes.
So another line of business would be, given your capital markets background, is to be trading Bitcoin stocks.
Yeah, exactly. And so many people have come to me with that notion of saying, hey, let's get into this whole like Bitcoin thing. Let's really like build up the travel component of all of this. And we're like, look, we're a full-time team of 5 people right now. We've got more and more companies coming onto our platform. We're learning from our users, but we're also trying to, it's really hard in tech when you have really big goals to not just want to do everything, but we're trying to prioritize our resources as effectively as possible to know that we're adding value with what we're doing right now, and then kind of getting an understanding of all the directions that we could go in the next 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Erica, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great chatting with you.
Erica Pearson is the co-founder and CEO of Vacation Fund. It's a platform that helps you save for your next vacation with the help of your employer, hopefully a generous one who will do the full match and send you on that trip to Thailand next month.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Rewards credit cards have many benefits. You collect points for every dollar you spend, and once you save enough points, it can go towards a free trip, a hotel room, even cash back. But is that free trip actually free? Of course not. Although many people support rewards cards and find them beneficial, there are also some critics out there. Christopher Elliott is one of those critics. He is the founder of Elliott Advocacy, a nonprofit organization that helps consumers resolve their problems. He's here to tell us why you should cut your rewards card into teeny tiny pieces. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
This is a contrarian view. I love it. Why should we cut our rewards cards into teeny tiny pieces? Emphasis mine.
I think the story that I wrote said smithereens. Rewards cards can be great, and there's a lot of talk online. You probably have seen it when people are talking about free miles and free trips that they get. But as you said in the introduction, someone has to pay for it. And once you start digging, you realize that that someone is, if you pay your credit card bill off every month, it's not you. It's the people who are not paying off their credit card bills who are getting hit by fees. It's the less affluent that probably shouldn't even have a credit card in the first place. It is these free miles, these free trips are all happening on the backs of the poor. At least that is some of the research would suggest that the less affluent people or the people who just don't know better are paying for all of this. And that strikes me as unfair.
Mm. It sounds like you, in the advocacy world, you've got a bit of a political bent here. Like, there's an equality essence to your view.
Well, if you want to go there, that's absolutely fine. I mean, I think that it's just common sense to want there to be a level playing field. And you know what strikes me as so unfair about all of this is that you have a very small group of people who are in the know. They study these card member agreements. They call themselves hackers sometimes, and they figure out how to get the most miles, the most points that they can, often through ethically questionable means such as manufactured spending, and that's basically where you're creating artificial, I would take 10 minutes to explain, but you're basically rigging the system so that it looks like you're spending a lot of money, but you're really not. And I just don't think that that's what that's a fair thing, a good thing for consumers. And I think that, you've got these wonderful first class seats and you have people who are sitting in them who have learned to manipulate the system. And then you have a lot of poor people who are basically footing the bill for those wonderful first class seats.
They're not on the plane. They're probably cleaning the toilets at the airport terminal. And for minimum wage, perhaps. I it's interesting to me, too, to look at the way rewards cards affect purchase behavior. So you hear these people who are like super excited about Double Points Day at their favorite retailer because they're going to get all these extra points. And I observe that behavior and notice that oftentimes those stores are the places that have the highest margin on the categories that they're so obsessed with, and that they'd be better off to go to a cheaper store and get their shampoo at a store that, you know, earned 3% profit versus 30% profit on their shampoo. How do you flag to consumers that sometimes their quest for rewards is a negative because it has them buy more or buy more expensive stuff?
You know, the only time that I can think of when collecting rewards is not negative is when you're a business traveler and you're going to spend the money anyway. You have to go with a certain airline, and because your company's policy says that you have to, you know, fly with Air Canada or whatever. Otherwise, it does it creates very destructive consumer behavior. You've got people who are, you know, they have a credit card and they have to, you know, they'll go with, for example, a seat on or a ticket on an airline that is less convenient and costs more, only so that they can be getting the miles. Or they'll go, as you say, to a grocery store or to a department store and spend money on products that are grossly overpriced just so that they can get the miles, not realizing, of course, that that's exactly the kind of behavior that these credit cards are meant to encourage. They want people to go in blind and buy things that they shouldn't be buying, probably. And, as I say, in the end, the house always wins. The credit card company is doing really well. The company is doing really well. Airlines, for example, are just making tens of billions of dollars on their rewards programs. And in the end, really, it's the passenger that gets stuck with paying the bill and often sitting in a terrible seat in the back of the plane.
Yeah. Are there any good seats left on a plane these days? I don't know. For those people listening to this program who do pay their credit card off in full, surely you're not recommending that they tear up their or cut up their rewards cards, because that would seem like they're just leaving money on the table. Would you recommend a cashback card instead?
Yeah, cashback cards are a little bit better. I mean, if you think that participating in a system that is unfair and takes advantage of the people who have the least in society, then, you know, by all means, stay with it. You should know, though, that your rewards those points and miles are going to decrease in value over time. So you're really better off, even if you're a very selfish person, you're better off spending all the points and miles and then cutting your card up and going with a payment system that makes more sense. Cashback is good. Go to a credit union, get one of their cards. Get something that doesn't charge an annual fee. Basically, it is just meant to be a credit card. It's not meant to be more than that. And I think people have gotten this thing in their heads where it needs to be more than that. You're using it to pay for things. So just, you know, get over it. Find something else, to find a different hobby.
One of the things you said in your article was that rewards programs can be incredibly confusing, which we know. Do you think that's a success factor for them, that the confusion means that consumers don't engage in the way that they work and it becomes very difficult to hack them?
Yeah. Well, what I said in the story was that their business model is confusion, and that is that they create these very complex payment systems that no one can understand, and that even people who work for the companies don't fully understand. And I think that kind of confusion is not good for consumers. It benefits a very small group of consumers that love reading contracts, and they get on these blogs and talk about how they can rig the system and they can, you know, generate more miles for themselves. But really, you think about the other things that use confusion as a business model, and credit default swaps come to mind. Those are the terrible things that caused the 2009 virtual collapse of the economy. And we just don't want more of that, I don't think.
Interesting perspective. Chris, we appreciate you taking the time to talk about it.
My pleasure.
Christopher Elliott is he's the founder of Elliott Advocacy, but he also wrote recently a contrarian piece on why you should cut your rewards card into tiny pieces. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, whether you know a little or a lot about philanthropy, Phil Buchanan's new book, Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count, will give you the necessary tools you need to make and impactful difference. And later, Kelly Keene, personal finance educator and consumer advocate for FP Canada, will be here to tell us about the results from the most recent household debt survey and give us some tips on how to tackle debt. Be sure to set up the Moolala podcast on subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, write us a review. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Total donations reported by Canadian tax filers rose to $9.6 billion in 2017. That is up just shy of 8% from the year prior, according to Statistics Canada. So big bucks here, but not everyone knows how to give their bucks in a way that is effective. Phil Buchanan is the president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy, my emphasis, not his, and the author of a new book called Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. He joins us now to tell us more about the book and provide us some insight on making an impactful difference. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
Giving Done Right. I got to ask, first and foremost, what are some examples of giving done wrong? I mean, if you part with the cash, isn't that most of the way there?
Turns out not so much. I think people get giving wrong all the time. And one of the biggest ways they do that is when they think they know what the solution is and fund something that turns out not to be effective at all. And it happens all the time. I mean, there's so many examples.
You say something that really struck me from your book, giving isn't investing, which is it's a contrarian statement, because a lot of people believe that philanthropy should have a market-based focus. It should be rigorous. It should be exactly like selling Pampers diapers, just for the greater good. What is different, in your view, between philanthropy and traditional business?
Yeah, I mean, let me be clear. I'm all for rigor, for being really clear about goals and strategy, for having performance indicators. I'm all for all of that. I just think all of that is really different when you're giving than when you're investing, for so many different reasons, maybe the most obvious of which is that there's no universal measure. So you can look at your investments in your retirement account, and you can judge them all by the same metrics, even in different industries, returns, or you can, judge businesses by their profitability. But in giving, there is no common unit of measurement. So you could reduce CO2 emissions by 10% in a geography and increase graduation rates by 10% in the same geography. Well, which one was better? There's no way to put those different accomplishments into a common unit of measurement. It's really complicated. So it's just one example.
How do you view the Gates Foundation, for example? Because Bill and Melinda Gates have extraordinary cred on the business front. My read of their approach is very market-focused, very data-driven. Do they fit in the done right or done wrong, in your view?
Yeah, great question. And I think they fit in both. So this is true of so many givers, that they get some things right and some things wrong. So in their global health work, there is no doubt that they have contributed. They haven't been the only player, and they'd be the first to say that, I think, to a massive reduction in childhood mortality worldwide. It's a tremendous accomplishment, often overlooked, and a great example of the way in which actually life has improved for the average person on planet Earth over recent decades. And they played a big role there, in part because it was pretty clear what needed to be done. A big part of that was get people vaccinated, and immunized, so that they do not die of diseases that they shouldn't fall victim to. On the other hand, their work, for example, in U.S. public education has not been nearly as effective. And that's because there is no simple solution to improving public education. But they have tended to seek the magic bullet. They said, let's break large high schools into small schools. That didn't work. They said, well, let's focus on evaluating teachers and tying their pay to their performance. That didn't lead to the kind of improvement that they hoped for. So then they said, let's focus on the curriculum and having a common core curriculum. There again, it didn't work out as anticipated. So I think this is a trap that a lot of givers fall into, which is the tendency to think really complicated problems are going to be subject to some innovation or quick fix solution.
You state quite controversially, I think, that not all goals are equally worthy. So don't just follow your heart. How do you define worthy? Is theater worthy? Are rare diseases worthy? What's worthy? And do you have an armed guard in front of your house at all times?
Well, I'm trying to take a balanced view of this argument that's playing out between those like probably most controversial would be Peter Singer, the Princeton philosopher and father of so-called effective altruism, who says, look, your $100 could, you know, save or dramatically improve a life in a developing country. So it's immoral to give it, you know, to the museum. Now, I don't believe that. I believe that it's important to use your head and your heart. I believe that it is important to think about what you can accomplish by giving in developing countries where your money might go further. And at the same time that we also have a natural instinct to want to give locally. I believe in supporting the arts. But I think these are questions you should ask yourself about, you know, what is the potential effect of my giving to different possible recipients? And you should query yourself about both what tugs at your heartstrings and sort of logically what you think will make the most difference. And then ultimately, it's a personal conclusion that you're going to come to.
You say just say no to people who ask for donations in the moment or use emotion to get us to donate. Another contrarian view.
Yeah.
It actually fits with mine, and I've modeled that in the home with our 9-year-old to say I'm very gracious with people who come to the door, but I let our daughter know that we don't give at the door. That's not our practice. What would you say that would support the way I've been handling it? Why am I handling that way, and why is that a good recommendation?
Well, because hopefully you've got some clarity about what your philanthropic goals are. And then you're not going to be able to give in a way that's consistent with those goals if you're merely just responsive to whoever shows up at your door. That's point number one. Point number two is, and I, as I say in the book, I had this job when I was in college. You know, I knocked on people's doors to try to raise money for a nonprofit in Oregon. That's not a good way to make decisions with somebody pressuring you in the moment. This should be something that you do, you know, thoughtfully in consultation with whoever in your family you want to consult, and in a way, again, that's consistent with what you set out as your priorities. And if you're just responsive, you'll look back at the end of the year and say, wow, really? I gave to that?
Right. What was I thinking?
That didn't make a lot of sense.
You have a great chart that overviews the differences between effective givers and ineffective givers. There's a couple surprises. For me, one of them was that ineffective givers see social enterprises as the best way to address social problems. I have long been a believer in the social enterprise model. What are the pitfalls? What are the leaks on that idea?
Yeah, I think it's not that you know, sort of hybrid social enterprises can't be a really good way to make a difference. They can be. It's just that the hype surrounding them, I think, has outpaced the reality of how frequently there isn't a way to make profit and do good simultaneously, right? So there are a lot of challenges in our societies that defy market-based solutions and sometimes are even a result of market failure. And that's often what philanthropy and nonprofits are working to address. So I just think we need to be careful not to romanticize the market too much and to recognize that there are some things, you know, we can't get done. I think I used the example in the book of, you know, if you're trying to help homeless kids, that's going to be, you know, government funding or philanthropy that's going to do that. There is, you're not going to ask the kids to host a bake sale. Mm. So not everything has an enterprise component, and not everything should.
A lot of the ideas in the book seem to focus on people with lots and lots of money, and I understand why that is valuable insight. In the 30 seconds that we have remaining, what advice would you give for people whose giving budget in a year is $1,000 or $500 or $2,000, what is the number one piece of advice for people who are not going to be the number one funder of malaria eradication?
Sure, sure. I mean, I'm going to cheat and say two quick ones, if that's okay. One
Fine.
Is to try to focus your giving, because you'll have a more sort of meaningful experience if you don't spread that funding across so many different organizations, but focus it a bit. And second, maybe do it with others. Find a giving circle, which have grown in popularity, you know, hugely over the last 5 or 10 years. Consider pooling your resources with a group of folks with similar interests. And that can be a great way to learn, have fun, and give more effectively than you might in isolation and without the benefit of others' wisdom.
Phil, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Bruce.
And thank you for being born in Canada. Maybe you'll move home at some point, because clearly this is your spiritual home and you just are awakening to that fact. Phil Buchanan, born in Toronto, lives in the U.S., raised in the U.S., president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. His book is called Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. Well, stay with us. Coming up next on the program, Dave Baldarelli joins us to talk about Modus Bank, a new full-service digital bank. Do we need a new bank? Is this important? Why do we need a new bank? I will ask him that very question. And How I Do It, we'll ask Vacation Funds Erica Pearson about how she manages her money. Missed an episode of Moolala? Don't worry, we've got you covered. You can go and listen to full episodes and also specific segments at any of the podcast providers or at moolala.ca. When you're at the podcast provider, subscribe, review, do all that fun stuff. And stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Canada has a new digital bank. It's called Modus Bank and was created by Meridian Credit Union. Dave Baldarelli, Modus Bank COO, joins us today to tell us more about it. Hello there.
Hello.
What's Meridian doing creating a bank? I thought that was a four-letter word for a credit union.
No, not at all. We've been very interested and excited about expanding nationally outside the Ontario borders, and we figured the best way to do it was through obtaining a banking license.
I don't have to tell you how hard it is to establish a new brand in the financial services marketplace. It's very, very difficult. Who is your target customer?
So our target customer is an individual who is comfortable and confident in doing their banking digitally. So demands a very good experience, demands value to be inherited from the experience, and also expects to be able to leverage different channels, chat, email, telephone, secured messaging, and video chat as well.
So how would you say you are different from Tangerine or Equitable Bank or other players that have a much longer time, a much longer history than you do?
Yeah, so great question. So I'd say there's no one silver bullet that completely differentiates Modus Bank from the players you mentioned, but really it's a combination of different elements under the value and experience umbrella. So when you take a look at value, Modus Bank offers very competitive rates and fees. Our platform delivers services that transcend banking. So we offer other services outside of typical banking.
Manicures, oil changes, what are we talking here?
Well, stay tuned. We'll park that one
okay.
for a second. But the other thing around value is basically we offer a full and innovative product suite. So some of the players out there are really monoline players, so they don't offer kind of the full spectrum of retail banking products. So that's I would say that goes under the value umbrella. And then from an experience perspective, you know, our platform is very easy to use. The member is at the forefront. The member feels empowered. All of our products are fulfilled digitally end to end. And like I said, along the journey, you pick up the phone, send an email, fire off a chat, whatever you want, we'll be there to help you. And then finally, I would say our member services team is really our secret weapon. So we have a member services team that's, always exceeds member expectations, and we deliver the highest NPS scores in the business.
Now, you've used the word members a bunch of times here, which if we were talking about Meridian would make perfect sense, but banks have customers. Are you even allowed to call them members?
Yes, we're definitely allowed to call the members, and that's one of the key differentiators of Modus Bank. Is everybody says this, but we really put the customer / member at the heart of everything we do, and we really wanted to exemplify that point by calling people members, because they're members of the Modus Bank family, right? And it's not completely unique in that, American Express, as an example, also calls their customers members as well. But, we really wanted to call that out. It reminds us each and every day that the member / customer is at the heart of everything we do.
Do they get a piece of the profit in a way that a credit union member would?
No, they don't get a piece of the profit, but they get to share in all the wonderful value proposition items that I spoke to earlier.
On your website, it's things like deposit checks from your phone, set up alerts. These are already things that the big banks can do. Let me ask you the same question I asked about Tangerine. How would you say you're really different from the big banks, because they have so much more money? They have entire, 100-person innovation areas that are working 24 hours a day to be the best option on digital. How do you compete with that?
Yeah, so some of the items, like it all stems from the fact that we put members first. So we're basically building solutions that help our members, right? Whereas, I would argue that sometimes the banks are more competing with one another or trying to maximize profits for the benefit of shareholders. So a lot of the things that we do, the services that we provide to our members are different, in that they really get to the true needs of our members, right? So that's kind of the first and foremost. I mentioned some of the other items, rates and fees. When you take a look at where we're at versus, some of the big banks, there's some differentiation going on there as well. And a lot of the banks don't offer that digital end-to-end fulfillment across all products. Modus Bank, again, you can get a mortgage, you can get an unsecured loan, unsecured line of credit. If you take a look at any of the big banks, including the digital players, you'll see that Modus Bank compares really well against them.
The other competitive threat for all Canadian financial services companies will be these unconventional players like Google, like Apple. And with the Apple credit card, when it arrives, you will apply on your phone, be approved instantly on your phone. I noticed on your website you will send a card in the mail. Isn't that a little 2017? What are you doing?
Yeah, it's a good point what you're bringing up. When people ask who Modus Bank's competitors are, I always reference the players that you're talking about here, the Amazons, the Googles, the Apples, because those are basically the companies that are delivering the experiences that really we want to be able to deliver, and those are the expectations that our members have. So those are really our key competitors. So we're starting out at X. We're on a journey here. We're ruthlessly focused on the member and making it simple for them to have a good life, and that's how we're going to win.
Member, you're a credit union. You can't be too ruthless. That'd be off brand. Right. That'd be off brand for you. Dave, thank you for your time and good luck with the launch.
No problem, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dave Baldarelli, the COO of Motus Bank, Canada's newest digital bank. Stay with us. Coming up, FP Canada's Kelly Keene will be here to take us through the results from the 2019 household debt survey. And How I Do It, we'll ask Erica Pearson what she actually does to manage her money in the day-to-day. If you've still got questions about money, maybe one of my books can help. You can order either of them online. The first one's called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. The second, the RRSP Guide, the Moolala RRSP Guide, to rocking your RSP. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We know household debt is a problem in this country. You hear it anecdotally all the time from people who are struggling, and the data really backs it up from so many different sources. One of those sources is the 2019 Household Debt Survey. It comes from Credit Canada and FP Canada, formerly the Financial Planning Standards Council. We're going to look at what Canadians have revealed about the debt that they carry today with Kelly Keene. She is a personal finance educator and consumer advocate for FP Canada. She joins us now from Edmonton, Alberta, to talk about the results of the survey and how Canadians can tackle their debt. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Great to be with you.
What are some of the findings from this year's survey? Was there some like fairy dust or magic that happened that changed everything from last year?
You know what? Canadians continue to be in debt. I mean, it's the number one rule of economics, right? Incentives drive the market. If we were having this conversation 30 years ago with double-digit interest rates, we would be talking probably about how people keep saving money because the incentive is there. And because interest rates continue to stay low, more and more Canadians are still in debt. So a couple of standout findings from this survey, 19% of those surveyed with debt, actually, this is a little bit heartbreaking for me, need to liquidate assets to actually help pay down their debt in 2019, cashing out RSPs, getting a second mortgage. And 62% of those with debt are anticipating taking on new debt this year, lines of credit, a new vehicle loan, credit card balance. So a lot of people still struggling with this, as you know, Bruce.
I was really surprised about that finding on the liquidation point. And I'm interested in talking more about what assets they would consider liquidating, because what I find is most people don't mind sitting on credit card debt. They just pay the minimum. And I'm minimizing it in some ways, but they view it as a chronic problem versus anything with urgency associated with it.
You make such a great point. I think a lot of people even just see that minimum payment as a bill. They don't question it. They see their mortgage payment as a bill. They don't question. They never get on a calculator online. I mean, you don't have to be good at math. There's the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. You can just Google them and calculator, or go to Credit Canada, and you'll see that just a few dollars more a day, in addition to making your minimum payment. Bruce, I don't know if you've ever opened up your credit card statement. I'm sure you have, and you know everything about it. But there's a little box either on the front page or the back. Our government actually legislated banks to show you how long it would take if you only made your minimum payment. And I think people just ignore that because, right, you get stressed, you get apathetic, and you do nothing.
So it also, I don't love it as a metric, to be perfectly honest, because I look at it and it says like 89 months. Well, I don't know what that means. What would be material to me is if you pay your minimum payment, you only your minimum payment, you will have to pay $300 in interest this month and $3,000 in interest over the course of the next 12 months. I think there are better metrics.
Absolutely. And that's the importance of not feeling apathetic, not feeling despondent, and that there is no hope, actually physically going onto that online calculator. Because if you punch those numbers in, you're going to get exactly that, Bruce. It's going to say it's going to take you this many years, this much interest. But $2 more a day saves you thousands of dollars in interest, let's say, or years off. And then you kind of get excited about that. You're like, wow, maybe
I can do this.
Can find $2 a day, you know?
The survey also found that almost two-thirds of Canadians with debt anticipate taking on new forms of debt in the year ahead. What are we talking about when we talk about new forms?
Right. So that's increasing their debt load. That means they feel that they're going to actually have to. Now, maybe some of those are valid, like a car loan or, you know, increasing their mortgage. We didn't get into the why, unfortunately, in the survey. But some of the concerning ones were, you know, taking on more credit card debt. So that is the why. And that underscores the importance of seeing someone like a nonprofit credit counselor or a certified financial planner. If you are already in debt and you're taking on more, either just to make ends meet, maybe not really examining the needs versus the wants, not understanding the full picture. And then if you're cashing in, an RSP, my goodness, this is where people really have to understand if you need $1,000 and you're taking it from your RSP, you're not getting $1,000 in your hands anyway. Yeah. You're going to be taxed. You're maybe even going to be taxed more at tax time, and you lose that room forever. So no judgment. People are doing it. They don't have, most Canadians don't have adequate emergency savings. But if you're doing that, please reach out and get help, you know, because that should be a last resort.
You have something called the 30-day anti-budget exercise. What's this?
Indeed, I do. I don't think budgets work. I think they're like diets. I think for the people that they work for, they work for. And those people don't need help. But for the rest of us that, you know, aren't great with diets or budgets, you need to have an awakening. And it's an exercise in behavioral change as well. So all I ask my readers to do is for 30 days, write down every single thing you spend money on. Now, you don't have to do this if you don't want. If you just use one credit card or one debit card, your bank is going to do all of that tracking for you. But you still need to dig. You need to be a little bit of a financial detective and go through everything you're paying for, Bruce. Bank fees, ATM fees, NSF charges, loan costs, all of this type of stuff. Then what you want to do at the end of the month, and research has shown that when you do this with your food intake, it makes a huge difference with weight loss. I haven't seen hard data on financial, counting your financial calories, but I know anecdotally it makes a difference for people. The end of the month, you categorize everything, and then it's an eye-opener for you and your family. Where is your money going? Not a set budget of what you should be spending. Where's your money going? And then once you see that, as a family, you can see where you want to trim the fat. And then, Bruce, once you have those categories of, you know, what's going for extracurricular activities or dining out or whatever, again, it's about choice and awareness, not sacrifice here. You decide, but also make sure you multiply it by 12, because now you see maybe your family does have more money for investments or debt repayment or a holiday if you just would pay attention to where that money's going.
I'm a big fan of that approach. And in particular, I like the writing it down in some sort of a journal, because I think there's a way to have you be conscious of your spending because you've got the pen and paper at all times. I think there's real power in that. I want to link this debt topic to you, to your work with FP Canada, because it's very easy for us to send people to a nonprofit credit counselor. That's what they do. Many financial planners either begin from the investing perspective, or they really feel like their compensation is exclusively tied to the investing part of it. What counsel do you have for Canadians who don't necessarily think of their financial planner in the context of debt? Because maybe they feel like, geez, I just went to my branch and they sold me a mutual fund and like that's kind of it. But you would probably argue there's a role for them to play.
Absolutely. And you make a very good point. There's a lot of misconceptions of how financial planners work or advisors. And there's so many terms, it makes it very confusing for the public. But let's just take someone like a certified financial planner. You're going to find two different types, and it depends on how they charge. So that is the first question. Now, there's fee-only financial planners that don't represent any product at all. They're not going to sell you a mutual fund or life insurance or anything. They're going to do analysis for you, and they're going to charge you by the hour, or they're going to charge you by the plan. So a lot of people might, let's say someone who's in debt, they have a decent income, but they have zero assets. The other financial planner or advisor that will only see you based on what assets you bring in, that person might be saying, well, a planner's not right for me because I don't have any money. But if you're willing to invest in a conversation like, maybe should you invest in RSP because you're a high income earner, take that tax deduction, pay it down on your debt. I'm just making something up here. They'll run that analysis for you, regardless if you have assets or not. So that's the first question. And if you go to financialplanningforcanadians.ca, that's our consumer website. There's some fantastic videos and articles there that will empower you to ask the right questions, either of your current advisor or planner, if you're shopping around for someone new. But that's one of your first questions is, how do you get paid and compensated so you know if you're going to the right person or not?
And make sure as a consumer you're getting the value for the money you're paying, because it is about much more than just the investment stuff. Kelly, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Kelly Keene, consumer advocate for FP Canada, formerly the Financial Planning Standards Council. She was here to talk about the 2019 Household Debt Survey. How I Do It. This is our series of questions trying to get at how people actually manage their money, the choices they make, the practices they have, what they actually do to keep on top of it all, which may be different than what the experts say. Our guest today is Erica Pearson. She is CEO and co-founder of a company called Vacation Fund. Erica, I want just the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
All right, I'll do my best.
You buy coffee at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit?
Credit.
Credit, and tell me why.
Because it's the most accessible thing, and I just lose coins in my pockets so easily.
What do you use cash for, if anything?
When I have coins available, I do use it for my coffee. I make coffee at home 3 times a week, and I buy it 2x a week.
How do you know that with such specificity?
I've been making bulletproof coffee, which for the health junkies, you'll kind of know what that trend is about. It takes a while, though. So that's 3 days a week. And then the other 2 days a week, I kind of give myself a break and say, oh, okay, more time in the morning, I'll just buy it.
What of your financial life is automated?
What of my financial life?
Of course, your vacation savings are automated. Hello.
My vacation, exactly. So my vacation saving is automated. I have had to shift it a little bit from my capital markets days. So it's actually interesting. My capital markets days, money was coming into my account and I automatically moved it to Tangerine just to keep it separate because I had no card to spend from Tangerine.
Right.
So I moved it to Tangerine and it's the money that I put away in my capital markets days that I initially used to fund my company, to fund Vacation Fund. So because we're in the first few years, I am paying myself very minimal salary, meaning that right now it's just going to cover my food and my rent. I'm about to increase my salary in the next few months, so that's exciting.
How do you navigate bills? How does that whole process work for you? Are you like super organized? Do you have a process? You have like a letter opener to open the envelope, or you wouldn't ever have an envelope because everything comes to you electronically. How do you manage bill paying?
Yeah, all electronically. I don't think anything comes to me in the mail anymore. And I make sure as soon as I receive the email, I pay it. I do not like to let things accumulate. I feel like it's an undone task and that stresses me out. So I pay it immediately, all online.
Do you have a budget?
Yes.
And yes. Did you in your capital markets days, or because you were basically dining out at Canoe every day and had like 14 personal trainers and lived at Holtz, you didn't have to, but now that you're a startup person, you have to?
I did have a budget because I was planning almost a year in advance to leave to start a company. So I would say in the first year and a half of capital markets, I had a budget because I was trying to say, okay, how much money am I putting aside so that by the time I'm, call it 29, I can have a good size down payment for a house. That's what I thought I was working towards. And then very quickly I said, oh, I think I want to start a company instead. So that's where that money went.
Right. Yeah. Well, that could be a better investment even than the condo in a major city. What, when it comes to money, what are you nuts about and what are you casual about? And I bet your answer is going to be informed by the fact that you're in startup mode, but maybe you're nuts about everything. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say I'm nuts about paying things immediately and never having owing money on my credit card for more than 10 days. Like, I always make sure that I am paying or prepaying my credit card at every chance I possibly get, which is a lot stricter right now because it's basically like, oh, this credit card, I owe $500 on it. I just got my paycheck. I'm going to pay that off immediately. So I would say I know the morning of when I got paid and what I have to use that to pay off or prepay to make myself more comfortable.
Who manages your investments, assuming that you didn't liquidate everything for the business in your RRSP or whatever you've got, DIY, robo, full service?
Yeah, it's kind of tangerine and I've kind of paid less attention to it than I could. And it's funny because especially in the tech world, like I know I'd want to get into trading and managing my money better myself because I was in that world, but I've just given myself the mental relief of saying, okay, this is where my focus is right now. My focus is on making the company that I started very valuable. So right now I'm just kind of letting it go. And sometimes I'm pleased with my returns and sometimes I'm like, oh, this could have been better.
Right.
But yeah, it's sitting in tangerine.
One last sneaker question here. Do you have, and you're young, do you have an actual financial plan? Aside from build this business and sell it to Facebook for $2 billion.
Yeah, I don't have an exact financial plan right now. I think like that sort of comes back to in the next few months, starting to pay myself above minimum wage, which that to me was even the fact that I've been able to pay myself at all is really, really great. And I've appreciated that. And I'm obviously with me, it was my responsibility to pay myself less than everyone else that's working for our company. But I think getting back up to closer to almost a normal person's salary in the next few months will say, okay, let me reevaluate this plan and reevaluate how I'm saving, where the money's going, put a little bit more thought into it when I have the breathing room to do that.
Wow. Well, best of luck with Vacation Fund, Erica. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Erica Pearson, that's how she does it when it comes to her money. Erica Pearson is the CEO and co-founder of Vacation Fund. Well, that is our show for today. If you'd like to join in on the conversation or at least get our recommendations on future vacation destinations, send an email to ask@moolala.ca. Or you can connect me with social media. Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala, Twitter @BruceSelry. Don't forget to download and subscribe to the podcast version of this show and also post a review. Even if it's like a 3-star, I will still permit you to, but it probably is 4, maybe even 5. Who knows? Thank you very much for joining us and have a great day.